different concept. It's a concept of bridging the gap between mainstream and alternative studies. If we're going to have a real future in these fields, eventually we have to do this. We have to be confronted with this path that we have to build and join these things together. This, in a sense, what I see is a movement of a new era in this school. One day, we'll all look back and we'll say, we saw history in the making.
Folks, give a hand for Thomas Busfield.
Whoa, well, here we are again, folks. Good evening. You are listening to Shifting Paradigms on the IPBN-FM network with your host, Thomas Fusco. And here we are for another Tuesday night episode here. Going to try to whip up some things in this hour. Some more about dark matter. I promised I was going to talk about more of it last week, and then I wound up getting into the economic thing. I should probably talk more about that. I've had a couple people tell me, gee, you ought to talk more about some of this economic logic and all this nonsense that you hear all these politicians talking about. We've been getting an awful lot of current events. Gosh, if I talked about politics, I could probably do a 24/7 show. The only thing I'd have to stop for eating and drinking and other things and sleeping and other than that, it'd tie up all the time just covering current events from the previous week. But you folks all know what's going on out there. You watch the news, you see what's happening. So I don't know. I don't really try to get too much into the political part of it if I can help it. Once in a while, it just gets so egregious that I have to get off of the scientific avenue and go down to more of the common type things that we all experience and we all have to deal with on a daily basis. Anyway, if you want to join into the chat room, you want to go to www.ipbn. That's Intrepid Paradigm Broadcast Network -FM. As in FM.com. And you'll see a link at the top of the page on the toolbar. Listen, chat. Click on that. You'll get into the room with the chat room and you'll be given a goofy name. You have to change it. All that good stuff. You guys know the routine. And really, if you want to put something in the chat room that you want to talk about or a question, I'll be happy to answer it for you. I'll be happy to talk about it if I can. I'm not an expert at everything, but excuse me, I do know a few things about some things. We also have a call-in number tonight. And Rocky, if you're there on the mic, do we have a call-in number?
We sure do. It is 651-760-8906. Once again, that is 651-760-8906.
Thanks a lot, man. Okay, folks, without further ado, there's a couple things I wanted to talk about tonight. The first thing was something that a friend on Facebook brought to my attention. And they were talking about funding for science, especially for things that aren't quite in the mainstream. And we've talked about that before. One of the problems that we have with the scientific establishment is that the funding for those science projects and those science experiments, you know, that research, comes from private organizations, mostly companies, corporations. Once in a while, you'll get some rich individuals that can fund certain projects. They're usually called foundations, and they give money to various causes, including scientific research, private corporations that are looking for a return on investment. They're looking for, you know, the next greatest filament for an incandescent bulb or something like that. And you have governments. And most of the time, governments are looking for better ways to build weapons or that kind of a thing. So there's a lot of things that slip through the cracks. And of course, these institutions don't want to be associated with anything that's fringe or weird, at least from the mainstream point of view. So there's a lot of kinds of research that these organizations and even governments aren't going to want to be associated with directly. So that's a challenge. And somebody that has a very interesting and useful and potentially world-changing, so to speak, idea, like yours truly, doesn't have a place to go normally. So somebody brought this to my attention, and it's actually something that I've been spending some time thinking about. I'm the kind of individual that when I do something, when I go about to do something, I like to see if I can visualize my way through it. I want to see how I'm going to end up at a particular destination. And I want to see if I can envision the road that leads to that destination. And that's not very adventuresome. I appreciate that. You know, there's a lot of folks out there that just say, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And this looks like a good idea. Let's go jump into it and do it. And I appreciate that. And there's a lot of good things that can come out of such impulsiveness. But oftentimes those impulsive decisions terminate in something that you didn't anticipate, and it's not anything that you wanted. So I like to see my way through from the beginning to the end. You have to excuse my little frog in my voice tonight. He comes and visits once in a while. Fortunately, not too often. Anyway, though, I was looking at this. This is called the Institute for Venture Science. And this is actually the name of the website. The Institute for Venture Science is one word, .net. Not .com, but .net. And what it says here, and this is very fascinating, this is interesting, says the Institute for Venture Science will fund high-risk, non-traditional scientific inquiries that may produce fundamental breakthroughs. We identify the most promising challenges to prevailing paradigms. Hey, I like that word. I use that a lot. We then simultaneously fund multiple research groups worldwide for each selected challenge. Says an unconventional idea pursued by a dozen laboratories cannot be ignored. And this is the point that they're trying to make here, because part of what's fundamental to science, and this doesn't necessarily have to be mainstream science, but this is at the core of science, beyond the dogmas, beyond the prejudices, pure science is replication. That you have to have multiple people being able to duplicate the same kinds of results in different locations using the information that's being provided by this theoretical work. This is very important. This is where they got into problems with that buzz a number of years ago about cold fusion. Everybody's heard of that, I'm sure. Where the idea was First of all, we know what fission is. Nuclear fission is the nuclear power that we're familiar with. It's what they dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's what we make our weapons out of. It's what we make our nuclear power plants around the world from. And what this is splitting the atom. And splitting the atom releases all this energy. Equals MC squared, you know, mass times the speed of light squared, which is a huge amount of energy that comes out of a small piece of mass. And we use highly radioactive materials because they're highly unstable and they're much easier to split apart and get this kind of reaction going where one particle flies off of a particular atom and then hits another atom and that gets messed up and flies off and hits something else. That's what a chain reaction is. And this is why what we call fissionable material is the stuff that does that most readily. Fusion is something different. Fusion is actually taking atoms and fusing them together. And that creates even more energy. We haven't been able to do it other than just micro fractions of a second. And under tremendous heat and tremendous pressure. So what you're basically talking about, let's say, for example, the most common idea of fusion is to take four hydrogen atoms and fuse them together in a helium atom. And if I'm remembering my chemistry correctly, and if not, you can come in the chat room and scold me very severely for it or even call. The hydrogen contains a single nucleus, a single proton, and a single electron, but no neutrons. Very simple. It's the simplest of atoms. And helium contains four of these. And so what you're doing is you're taking four hydrogen atoms and fusing together into one helium. And that is an incredible source of energy to be able to accomplish that. Much cleaner and much more sustainable than fusion or fission. The problem is that we've not been able to accomplish this in other than in tiny fractions of a second under extremely high temperatures and velocities and pressures. Well, these folks came through a while back ago and said, we have figured out how to do this at normal temperature and pressure, what we call STP, standard temperature and pressure. And so it got the nickname of cold fusion. And the problem with cold fusion, the report sounded great, but the problem with cold fusion was that nobody could reproduce it. Nobody could replicate it. They tried the same experiments that were tried or described by this particular research team, came up with nothing. And so it was immediately discredited. And then, of course, in our alternative community, here comes the conspiracy theorists, God help us, that talked about, well, this was a reality, this could be done, because they really wanted it to be so. And the establishment, the man, conspired to hide it and discredit it and all this. Oh boy. You hear it all the time. They did the same thing with the fellow that's supposed to be the fellow in Italy that's supposed to be demonstrating 0 point energy, being able to extract and tap in on 0 point energy. Which, by the way, Rocky, I probably should have a show on zero-point energy, too. Because that doesn't get talked about in a way that it should. Let me make a note of that. We'll do that in an upcoming show. Zero-point energy happens to be the lowest energy level that is possible in the fabric of space-time. And that there's supposed to be a standard or a minimum presence of energy that exists within the fabric of space-time itself, even in a vacuum, and that these people supposedly have harnessed it. Now, you hear this all the time. You even see it on these, if you buy the right magazines, or if you listen to the right radio stations like Alex Jones, you will get commercials that talk about how you too can purchase and assemble a zero-point energy machine and have free energy just coming out of the, literally out of space, literally. And folks, it just isn't there. I got into a fight with a host one time when I was on a radio interview. When I mentioned, the show was kind of dark anyway. I don't even remember the name of it, but if you remember that V or Z movie where all the guys wore the funny masks with the big mustache on them, the white face. Well, this is the mask that this guy wore on his promotional website page. So I should have known better than to be on that show. But at the time, I was an interview prostitute. You know, I would go on any show that anybody wanted me on. And so I mentioned something about fallacies. And I just happened to mention this area, and he happened to be a very big supporter of it, a believer in it, I should say. So we got into a bit of a conversation on that. I'm sure somewhere in some ancient archive back in the early part of 2012 somewhere, if you search the vast universe of the internet, you may find that interview. And I think if you listened to it, you would laugh. Anyway, though, getting back to the point, these things are not replicable. People, other laboratories are not able to replicate them. So this is why in the very, the second paragraph of their introduction of what they do, this Institute of Venture Science, they say an unconventional idea pursued by a dozen laboratories cannot be ignored. So even the prejudicial dogma of establishment and mainstream science and physics couldn't really ignore that kind of results if we had a dozen laboratories around the world working on this same project. This means the challenge that challenge paradigms can compete on equal footing with prevailing paradigms, which we like because we are all about shifting paradigms here at IPBN. The superior one should prevail. Yes, that's true. The better model is going to ultimately prevail, even if it takes quite a long time. The strategy of producing a critical mass for promising ideas can produce fresh, diverse understandings of the world in which we live. Which, you know, I'm all for that. That's why I started on my journey, asking the fundamental question, what is the nature of reality? But from a scientific basis, I wanted to know quite simply how the universe was put together. And so this was how what I pursued. So I like what this is saying. So it goes on. It says, gaining fresh understanding may seem an outright luxury in today's culture of practicality. I was just talking about that. I've talked about that before. When it comes to funding, it's the fund source is going to say, what's in it for me? Can you build me a better mousetrap that I can make more money on? Can you build me a better weapon in which I can kill more people more quickly with it? However, human existence faces unprecedented threats. Dwindling energy resources. Oh, yeah, there's one. Diminishing supplies of potable water. Now, let's talk about a couple of those for a second. Dwindling energy resources. You know, what this refers to is the idea that our natural resources are not infinite. There's only so much gold in the ground, for example, or copper, for example. There's a ton of it. There's lots of it, but there's only so much. There's a finite supply of it. And so one of the things, now we all hear about oil. Oil is going to dry up in 40 years, 50 years, all that. And it could be. I don't know. You listen to different sources and you hear different things. I like to read some of the scientific periodicals because at least you get a little bit of a better idea than in the mainstream news, which is most of it's just a bunch of garbage. I dread watching the news, and I'll listen to what I want to listen to. And then as soon as they start talking trash with the talking heads and all that, I flip the channel to something else when I have time to watch TV. But reading these scientific periodicals really helps because you get a little bit of a better insight. They know they're writing for the egghead. They're not writing for the general mass public. So it's a little bit of a different perspective. And you read these kinds of things about supplies dwindling. I just saw an article about the drought that's in California. And if any of you folks have seen the photos of some of these huge reservoirs that they made by damming up these huge rivers, and you look at the reservoirs and they're maybe 15 to 20% of their normal pool, they're running out of water, folks. And it continues year after year to be dry, dry, dry. And some people feel that climate change, there's a buzz term for you, is causing this, and they don't see any long-term relief that California is just getting worse and worse and worse. Now, this is what my wife says is attributable to some of the pathetic vegetables that I've been seeing in the store over the last few months. I mean, gosh, when was it? A few weeks ago. Now, once in a while, yes, folks, I actually do grocery shopping once in a while. It's not my wife that does it all. And oftentimes when she goes shopping, I go with her. So now, you know, I'm not the typical male chauvinist, whatever they call that. but I go shopping sometimes. And a few weeks ago, I went to the store. I was appalled by what they had on the shelves as heads of lettuce. I mean, you picked them up and they weighed nothing. They were tiny and they weighed nothing. A good head of lettuce should weigh at least, a small good head of lettuce should weigh at least a pound and a half. You pick that out of the rack, you put it on the scale. And lettuce is traditionally sold by the head. It's not sold by the pound. So, I mean, I was looking. There must have been about 30 heads of lettuce in the bin, and I couldn't find one that weighed even a pound. And they wanted like $1.79 for them or something like that. It was crazy. And so my wife tells me this is due to the water shortage in California, where these huge agribusinesses grow all this stuff. Could be. One of the problems that we have with shrinking resources, and this is something that you won't read anywhere except in a scientific journal or a scientific periodical. And I don't know, I guess if they publicize this, this would cause widespread panic. In order to feed our people, one of the things that is necessary is fertilizer. Now, you'll hear all this, this buzz about genetically altered plants and I think they call them GMOs. And everybody on the internet is all crazy over this. Oh, we don't want this. This is the big bad man again shoving these things at us. And there's some truth to it. I'm not trying to poo-poo it all. There are some very, especially with the latest understanding that we're beginning to get about genetic mutation and what we call genetic drift, there is some concern about these GMOs. I don't know whether they've been fully experimented or fully researched the way they should, because it takes years and years to research something like this to see if these things cause genetic drift, where adjacent living species actually get genes borrowed from completely unrelated species that they drift over, or they come in with food. It's a factor that really hasn't been considered until recent years. But the point I'm trying to make is that the GMOs are not the most immediate problem that we have, folks. It's fertilizer. Fertilizer is based in a large part, one of the large components to commercial fertilizer that all farmers use is phosphates. Phosphates, you've heard of that before. But it is a fundamental constituent of fertilizer. Guess what, folks? We're running out of phosphates. We don't have that many decades of it left. And nobody has any idea how we're going to replace it. Now, this is one of the things that they're talking about, dwindling energy resources. Well, it may not be directly energy, but it is a dwindling resource. In another 20 to 30 years, we may not be able to supply enough fertilizer to feed the world. Now, that's a scary thought. I know you haven't read that in the mainstream media, but that's what's going on. Florida's used to be a big, big source of phosphates. And they still dig it here and there, but most of the phosphate mines in Florida have been empty for years. They've actually filled them with water and made fishing holes out of them. You can go up the Withlacoochee River, for example. If you look on a map, you'll see where that is. Beautiful river. If you ever come to Florida, take a boat ride. Go to Dunellen and rent a boat and take a ride down to Withlacoochee. It is absolutely, it is the quintessential southern river. And you'll fall in love with the place, trust me. But you see all these little ponds off to the side that are connected to the main body of the river. And you drift over into them, and they're super deep. And now they've got homes lined around them. They're like little harbors where people can get their, you know, private property and be on the lake there or on the river. And these are all phosphate pits. You see the old pilings from where they used to actually have the roads and the train trestles that would truck this phosphate out into the commercial market. All that stuff is gone. It's all decayed, disassembled. All the pits are all filled in with water. They're just not here anymore. And so they're still digging it in places, but we're running out of it. So it says, these are the things that we need to research: dwindling energy resources, diminishing supplies of potable water, increasing incidence of chronic disease. You know, the miracle that we came up with just the last century of penicillin and antibiotics. Excuse me, the bugs are getting smart now. They're actually mutating in a way so that it doesn't affect them any longer. We are, it's more serious than what people realize. They've heard of it, but we are drifting out of the age. We're leaving the age of miracle antibiotics. They're desperately searching for new ways to to combat these infections, these bugs. Or we're going to be in serious trouble. There's going to be a whole lot of people that are going to die. And this population explosion that we've experienced in the 20th century is going to get peeled back quite a bit between food, the diseases. It says practical solutions have always come from scientific breakthroughs. Antibiotic addressed the problem of bacterial disease. The discovery of electricity solved the problem of worldwide communication, as well as a million other things. More than ever, the world needs revolutionary breakthroughs to break the logjam of existential crises that threaten our survival. By fostering breakthroughs, the IBS will enrich the world with fresh vision and help create viable solutions for today's seemingly intractable problems. So this is really something that's very worthwhile. We can't always fund something, or all the funding can't, you know, always going to make a better widget, to make more money, or to make better weapons. We have to figure out how we're going to save ourselves. And this is what this, you know, this is what this organization wants to focus on. So we're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a short break to pay the bills. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this, maybe get into dark matter or anything like that. Of course, if you want, like I said, call in or get in the chat room and speak your mind, and we'll talk about that. But in the interim, we're going to be right back. You're going to listen to the other half hour if you stay with us.
Jeddah in the M&M Survivor Challenge. The sun beats down on the empty quarter.
Hold on, Red. I need a drink. That's better.
Hey, Yellow, go easy with that water. It's got to last till Dubai.
Okay, Red, I'll be careful.
Guess how many weeks it will take Red and Yellow to cross the empty quarter desert from Jeddah to Dubai and win great M&M survival kits with laptop, mobile phone, and GPS tracking system, and lots more. Count the colors inside M&M's packs for a clue.
Yellow, you crazy nut, the water, it's all gone.
Ow, you don't have to hit me.
We'll never make it now.
Subway Restaurant's Storytime Theater proudly presents Jack and the Beanstalk.
Fee-fi-fo-fum. I smell something delicious. Hey, little fella, what you got there?
Oh, this? It's the big hot pastrami sub from Subway Restaurants.
Mmm, that does look tasty.
It sure is. Climbing that beanstalk out there makes you hungry.
You mind if I have a bite?
Sure! I'll trade you for that goose over there with the golden eggs.
You got a deal!
Hungry for something big? Then pick up a big hot pastrami sub from Subway Restaurants. Layer upon layer of delicious hot pastrami stacked high and toasted to flavorful perfection on freshly baked bread. Topped with pickles, mustard, and melted Swiss cheese, it's the perfect way to satisfy any giant-sized appetite. Big Hot Pastrami, available at participating restaurants for a limited time only. See restaurants for details. Subway, eat fresh.
I remember a loud noise, and then everything went black.
I was set on fire, and I couldn't breathe.
I saw the fireball. Everybody was panicking. I have never been so afraid in my life.
Everything changed after that.
I'm Trace Adkins. I want to tell you about these true American heroes and how you can show your thanks by helping them through Wounded Warrior Project.
The person who went to Iraq is by far not the same person that came back.
I was very isolated. I didn't want to talk to anybody.
I felt like there was no one there. There was no hope.
There's this feeling of brokenness, not being the person that I used to be. I had thoughts of end of my life.
Your gift today of $19 a month can help us provide the programs and services desperately needed by our wounded service members.
When a person is scared and confused and alone, when a warrior project has been there to help them.
The needs aren't going away. Post-traumatic stress disorder is not going away.
The wounded warriors that are out there need help. They're going to be around for years to come.
Call or go online with a pledge of $19 a month, and you'll receive this Wounded Warrior Project blanket.
I'm able to do a lot more now. I've come a long way.
It's so much emotional healing that goes on.
It's great to know that there's an organization out there who's willing and able to help.
The job of helping thousands of our wounded warriors rebuild their lives is massive. That's why your gift of $19 a month is so important. Please call or go online right now.
Okay, folks, we're back. You're listening still to Shifting Paradigms with your host, Thomas Fusco, on the IPBN-FM network. Go to IPBN-FM.com and listen. Click on the listen and chat button and get in that doggone chat room. And if you want to call in, we've got the call-in number. Rocky, I'm sorry. Please give it to me again.
Sure, it's 651-760. Wow, I just had a little 651-760-9. Wow, Thomas, why are you doing this to me, brother?
It's called brain plaque, man.
Well, you know, we got a lot going on here. It's 760-8906. I cannot believe that just happened. 651-760-8906. Thank you, Thomas.
See, radio is supposed to be entertaining, which is why I like you to come in and give the phone number. It just it adds a little bit to it, and of course it gives me a break.
Thanks, Thomas.
Oh boy, even if it's only a couple minutes. Anyway, folks, we were talking about this institution. This now I have it too. The Institute for Venture Science. Yes. What's my name? 5 seconds, Bob. You guys remember that? Where that was an old Cheech and Chong album where for the contestant question, in order for him to get the prize, he had to give his own name. And he couldn't figure it out until they said 5 seconds, Bob. And oh, it's Bob. Oh, well, I get like that more and more every day. Anyway, what the interesting part I wanted to mention this was mentioned on this was they wanted to talk about what the requirements to send a pre-proposal is. And this is something that I talk about all the time. All right. They has to have, according to their requirement, you have to be able to list predictive experiments. This is the thing in science and theory that everybody forgets. Predictive experiments. If you have a theory, if you have a concept, it's going to have a certain characteristic that's going to reflect an aspect of reality. That aspect of reality that your theory is predicting that exists, or it exists in a certain way, or in a certain structure, or in a certain place, that has to be experimentally testable. You can test the substance, the face of physical reality. And so if this says that, gee, you know, we picked up these particular, radiation emissions that are of a greater concentration coming from a certain area of deep space, and that they have a particular characteristic that's unusual. It's something that we haven't seen before. That based on our theoretical understanding, this evidence leads us to believe, if our theory is correct, that there's a certain kind of astronomical object out there emitting that particular radiation. And so what's the experiment? The experiment is that this structure should have other characteristics that we could set up instrumentation and point it in the right direction and measure to see if we find those things that are predicted by this theoretical idea. Or it could be just as simple as pointing the thing, a telescope over there, and say, look and see if there's something there. Because according to what we're getting, if our interpretation is correct, it predicts that there should be an object at a certain location out there in deep space that is the source of this radiation that we're getting. That's how science works, folks. That's how theory works. So these folks are into it because they're asking for this kind of an idea. You know, you have to have predictable or experimentally, what they call predictive experiments. You have to say, my proposal, my theory predicts this, and this is what an experiment conducted in such and such a way should see if my theory is true. Then they can go to these laboratories and not just say, oh, well, gee, just research this. This guy sent in his good idea. Let's research it. They can go to those laboratories and say, here, this is what we're testing for. This is the concept. You need to put together and conduct this particular experiment that predicts this kind of a result. And this kind of work is important. So I've been looking at this, thinking about it, and saying, well, hey, maybe my own supergeometric theory might be a good candidate for something like this, because my theory actually does make predictive, does have predictive experiments. Now, there's an astronomical one that's very easy. And I've talked about it before. They have to, the idea is that if they, the deeper they look out into space, which is the further back in time, the lower the percentage of gravitational effect is going to be to visible mass. If my theory is correct, that would be one of the things that they could check for. And if they find it, that's a strong indication that I'm on the right track. If they don't find it and say, no, it's not, then that's what's called a falsification. In other words, that's a finding that would falsify the theory. I know it's kind of a weird way of saying it, but that's what we talk about in science, falsification. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about dark matter again, because you know it's one of my favorite subjects. And the reason why it's one of my favorite subjects is because the whole idea behind dark matter is that we have consistently strong observations of physical effects, you know, cause and effect. We have very strong observations of physical effects with no visible physical cause connected to the effect. It's just like it's magic. It happens all by its lonesome. And this brings us to a fundamental question about the way the universe is put together. That's why dark matter is so very, 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 very important. And anyway, that's one of the reasons why I talk about paranormal phenomena. Because the paranormal is the same kind of thing. It's a physical effect that you can see, that you can experience, that you can measure, that you can even record with no immediate connected physical cause. That's not supposed to happen. It's an effect with no physical cause. I mean, there's nothing abnormal about hearing somebody's voice. We hear it all the time. You're hearing it right now. You know, anytime you have a conversation with somebody or turn on the TV or the radio, you hear another human voice. There's nothing paranormal about that. But in all those instances, we know the physical local source that's locally connected to what you're hearing, either through a set of vocal cords or through, electric magnetic compression waves that go through your internet and play out on your computer, or acoustic compression waves, all those kinds of things. In paranormal phenomena, there ain't no set of vocal cords, folks. In mystery voices, EVPs, AVPs, there is no set of vocal cords. There is no local physical cause in the environment that's directly connected to the effect. It's like we have an effect with no cause. And guys, that has something to do fundamentally with the way the universe is put together. So this is an article. I wanted to address an article that is in a recent Scientific American. I keep telling you guys, get a subscription for this. You who like what I talk about and the subjects that I discuss, you need to get a hold of this magazine, man. It's a good one. And this is an article that starts, "The beautiful spinning pinwheel of the Andromeda Galaxy, our celestial neighbor, poses a mystery. The breakneck speed of its rotation cannot be explained by applying the known laws of physics to the disk's visible matter, to its visible matter. By rights, the gravity generated by the galaxy's apparent mass should cause the stars in the periphery to move more slowly than they actually do." That's around the outside, folks. I needed to look that up too. I'm sorry. "If the visible matter was all there, Andromeda and nearly all such quickly rotating galaxies simply should not exist." In other words, if the laws of motion and all the physical laws that we know were the only things at work in these galaxies to produce what they do, that they're distributed the way they are and they move at the speed that they do, they couldn't exist. "Cosmologists believe that some unseen kind of matter, dark matter, surrounds and permeates Andromeda and other galaxies, adding the necessary gravitational force to keep them spinning as observed. Dark matter, which appears to contribute about 25% of the universe's mass," and that's been fluctuating now too. Some people are saying as high as 80. When I first read about dark matter, they were saying that it comprised 85% of the universe's mass. Now, they're talking about perhaps maybe 25% of its mass. So even now, the establishment numbers are changing. Sometimes people think that physics is hard and fast, and that scientists often do publicly express it in that way to the general public, that, oh, it's hard and fast. Only a few other facts we need and we'll know it all. But the reality is they're still trying to figure out what we have now, whether some of the observations we have are actually accurate or not. And we're discovering new things all the time that do away with the old paradigms. This invisible dark matter would also explain other aspects of the cosmos, including the exceedingly fast motion of galaxies within clusters of galaxies and the distribution of matter arising when two clusters collide, and the observation of gravitational lensing, the bending of light by gravity of distant galaxies. You know, the problem is, and here they go on, and I want to read this because it's very well written. "The simplest theories of dark matter postulate a single kind of as yet undiscovered particle contributing the unseen mass. But despite decades of searching for direct evidence of the dark matter particle, no one has been able to prove its existence." Now, this is 2015, July 2015. Guys, I've been chanting this, you know, this particular canticle for years. And yes, I was looked down upon in certain sources for not signing on to this dark matter. Because my theory predicts these kinds of effects in the universe without the need for dark matter. People say, well, where's your mathematics? Well, where the hell are the mathematics that caused them 5 years ago to say 85% of the mass in the universe is dark matter? And today they're saying 25%. Where was their math? And if they had math, I guess it wasn't right. They got that screwed up. They had somebody punching numbers out for them, that's for sure. No one's been able to prove its existence. I've got another article in here that says they're just simply losing hope. They're slowly coming to the acceptance that what they thought dark matter was, isn't. And I've been talking about this for years. I kept saying, I stuck my nose out, or my foot out, or whatever you want to say, and just said boldly, publicly, they will not find dark matter. It doesn't exist. And you can imagine my delight when I've been reading these things over the years. And the more recent articles is that, oh, geez, well, maybe we were wrong about this. Maybe we have to look at this in a different way. Well, they're going to go down another materialist avenue. So they're going to try a different path. But I'm predicting here and now tonight on this radio station, on this radio program, to everybody that's listening to me, that they're not going to succeed there, too. Excuse me, that they too will come up with a dead end going down the path they're talking about going now. So what the idea is now is that the combination of these, here we go. Further, a few discrepancies remain between astronomical observations and this simple theory. In other words, they can't put the observation together with the theory of dark matter. They still haven't been able to kind of get that right. But I'm supposed to have exacting formulas. Not these guys, me. I'm supposed to have them. The combination of these residual disagreements with the failure to detect this elusive substance has led some scientists to question their traditional theories and imagine a more complicated form of dark matter. Instead of a single type of particle, dark matter might be made of a wider array of dark species. Oh, here we go, folks. After all, ordinary matter comes in many forms. Maybe dark matter is similarly complex. Over the past few years, scientists have increasingly come to suspect that several varieties of dark matter exist, and perhaps even more intriguing, that previously unsuspected forces act strongly on dark matter and very feebly or not on at all on ordinary matter. So what they're saying is that this dark matter realm not only has its own particles, its own dark atomic structure, but it also has its own forces that interact within the dark universe, but that don't interact with the visible universe, with the measurable matter and energy. Now, that's a freaky concept. What we're doing is actually talking about a parallel realm. And in this case, in some way, it mirrors our normal realm, or is closely linked to it, that we could call it something parallel. You know, normally when people talk about parallel universes, literally what that means is that you would have another universe parallel to ours that would be identical to ours. Otherwise, it would not be parallel. It would be some other kind of an angle. So this is very interesting. Now, again, I have to remind people that supergeometry, my theory of supergeometry, talks about a super geometric, a super physically physical overlay onto regular reality. Is it kind of like a parallel realm? Yes, it is, but it is not physical. And this is what causes the effects that these folks have been seeing. This is also what I claim, and I talk very much in my book about it, Behind the Cosmic Veil, about how this super geometric layer is the cause for paranormal phenomena, and I describe the mechanics of it. It also caused the beginning of the universe. Except that my model, it's not physical. That part of reality isn't physical. And so not being physical, it's not part of the materialistic paradigm. And not being part of the materialistic paradigm, mainstream science is going to reject it because the prevailing paradigm is that if it's not material, it doesn't exist. So this is why they're going down these avenues trying to get these more elaborate schemes for dark matter. Recent observations of colliding galaxies may provide preliminary support for this hypothesis. And such forces could help explain some of the discrepancies between the basic dark matter. The basic dark matter model and observations. If complex dark matter exists, it would make for a more interesting and intricate universe than cosmologists usually imagine. So, what they're talking about is this, and this is, you know, really basic, but this is good enough. I mean, if you grab this, you know what's going on, what they're talking about. So let's say we have a typical atom that has a proton. Let's talk about something that has a higher atomic number than hydrogen, that has protons, plural. And neutrons and electrons. And these are all standard particles in visible mass. And then they have forces that interact with one another. The strong and weak nuclear forces are part of those, that they help bind together nuclear components. And then we have electromagnetism. And, of course, we have gravity, which is difficult to qualify on a subatomic level. What they're talking about with the complex dark matter is that you have dark protons, dark neutrons, dark electrons that nobody can see and detect that make up dark atoms and molecules. But they have their internal forces too. And their internal forces would be like dark strong force, dark weak force, dark electromagnetism. And because they're dark, they only interact with their dark companions, but do not interact with normal matter. It would be like, you know, if you had a piece of steel and a piece of aluminum with a magnet. And if you put the magnet towards a piece of steel, the steel will respond. It will react because the force of the electromagnetism is reacting with the piece of metal that's adjacent to it. What they're saying is in the dark universe, that it's like having a piece like a magnet, but you're sticking it towards aluminum. And if aluminum was like our normal matter, and the dark energy is like this magnet, the dark force, the force would be there, but we would never know it because we could never measure the effect on the aluminum or see the aluminum move as a result of the presence of that dark force. So that's the interesting idea, what I wanted to talk about with dark matter tonight. This is how this idea is evolving in science. They're getting further out on the limb, in my opinion. And I have to sit here and chuckle to myself and say, guys, why don't you just consider for just a second that there is no such thing as dark matter or dark energy, that the observations that you have are due to something else, and then look at supergeometric theory. And they will someday, folks, they will. They may not call it that. They may not remember me, but you will. Folks, we're at the end of another hour. Thanks for coming in and listening. Always enjoy to have you here. We'll be back next Tuesday night with another harebrained episode of Shifting Paradigms with your host, Thomas Fusco, on the IPBN-FM network. We'll see you then. Thanks for coming.